From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Attorney General just says no. We look at Janet Reno's decision not to seek an independent prosecutor to investigate the president, vice president, and others, a conversation about the FBI crime lab and racism, and we go to Ottawa and Kyoto for the summits on global warming and landmine prohibition. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Janet Reno has rejected seeking an independent counsel for President Clinton and Vice President Gore. The Attorney General's decision not to seek an inquiry into fundraising calls by the President and Vice President wasn't unexpected. But other senior Justice Department officials regard the decision as a narrow one and are actively searching for a way to hand over to an outside prosecutor the entire investigation into 1996 campaign financing. Reno also decided against an independent counsel to investigate former Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary concerning a meeting in exchange for a donation. The FDA has approved irradiation as a safe way to rid meat of bacteria. The agency approved use of gamma rays in low dosages on beef and other red meats, such as lamb, and changed the dosage levels for pork. But few meat processors seem willing to be the first to bring irradiated beef, lamb, or pork products to the market. Doctors, nurses, and healthcare students held a Boston Tea Party yesterday of sorts. They dumped year-end reports of for-profit hospitals into the Boston Harbor. Dr. Timothy McCall is an internist who is one of the organizers of the Ad Hoc Committee to Defend Healthcare.
We're talking about corporate-controlled healthcare. We're talking about the large for-profit HMOs and the for-profit hospital chains that are having all kinds of policies, throwing people out of the hospital before they're really ready to be discharged, denying medical tests. We're seeing for-profit healthcare chains, Tenet and Columbia HCA, both have either records of felonies or have been charged with them or investigated for them. The for-profit nursing home industry has been a disgrace, and we see this increasingly taking over healthcare.
In today's edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association, 2,300 doctors, nurses, and healthcare students signed a call to action to remove profit from the healthcare industry. Northern California's Marin County approved a plan yesterday to register patients who use marijuana for medical purposes, giving them a certificate to prove they're not criminals if stopped by police. The Marin program, approved unanimously by the County Board of Supervisors, marks a fresh attempt to overcome legal ambiguities created by California's Proposition 215, which last year made it one of the first states in the country to legalize the medical use of marijuana. In international news, an Egyptian man charged with belonging to the country's largest Muslim militant group blamed the government today for the killing of 58 tourists in Luxor last month. Mustafa Hassanin, among a group of 65 men on trial at the military court northeast of Cairo, said the government's rejection of a truce call from his group, Al-Gamaa al-Islamiyya, which is an English Islamic group, had prompted Islamist gunmen to shoot and hack to death tourists. The Gama claimed responsibility for the Luxor attack, which was the bloodiest since it took up arms against the government in 1992 to set up an Islamic State in Egypt. The trial opened on November 17th, the day six gunmen killed the tourists at a temple in Luxor. The new head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, known as the IAEA, said today he saw no signs that Iraq had resumed a nuclear weapons program during the temporary absence of Western inspectors. Under the Security Council's 1991 Gulf War resolutions, the Vienna-based IAEA is responsible for scrapping Iraq's nuclear weapons capabilities and ensuring it does not reacquire them. UNSCOM performs a similar task for Iraq's chemical, biological, and ballistic missiles programs. The Reverend Jesse Jackson today urged Zambia to strengthen its fragile democracy, to improve the lives of its people and attract foreign investment. Jackson, who is in Lusaka as President Bill Clinton's special envoy for democracy in Africa, urged the Zambian government to bolster the institutions of democracy and to begin talks with disgruntled opposition leaders. Zambian opposition parties are demanding fresh elections after they boycotted elections a year ago to protest against constitutional changes approved by President Frederick Chiluba, which effectively barred his main rival, former President Kenneth Kaunda, from participating in the polls. And the former head of Winnie Madikizela Mandela's Soweto entourage today gave harrowing testimony at South Africa's Truth Commission of summary judgments and deadly punishment meted out by her bodyguards. Jerry Richardson, who is serving a life sentence for the 1988 murder of Stompie Sepe, told Archbishop Desmond Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, "My hands are full of blood." He said he was doing the killing at the behest of Mandela. Richardson was a police informant when he worked for Winnie Mandela. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's still unclear what the fallout will be over Attorney General Janet Reno's decision not to seek an independent prosecutor to investigate campaign fundraising phone calls by President Clinton and the vice president. Although many had predicted Reno would not appoint an independent counsel, her decision drew fire from Republicans who accused her of violating her role as attorney general. Some even called for her resignation. Reno concluded that President Clinton and Vice President Gore did not violate the Pendleton Act when they made campaign fundraising calls from the White House. The Pendleton Act, which dates back to the 19th century, was intended to prevent the solicitation of federal employees on federal property. But the wording of the statute is vague, and under the Act, and some legal experts argue that solicitation on federal property is illegal under the Act, period. Reno found the White House is not covered under the Pendleton Act, and in the case of Al Gore, he solicited money for the Democratic Party, not direct campaigns. He therefore did not violate the law. Well, we're joined right now by Don Simon. He's executive vice president and general counsel of Common Cause, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan lobbying organization based in Washington, which promotes open and accountable government. More than a year ago, Common Cause sent a letter to the attorney general encouraging her to appoint an independent prosecutor. Don Simon, your reaction to Janet Reno's decision announced yesterday?
Well, the decision she announced yesterday was made on a very, very narrow basis about the very technical question you stated of whether the Pendleton Act was violated. But the question was really a kind of irrelevant one about whether the president and vice president essentially used the wrong telephones to raise money during the 96 campaign. That's not really very important, and it's not really the focus of the problem that happened in the 96 campaign. The real focus and what we need an independent counsel for is whether the president and his campaign, and indeed the Dole campaign as well, engaged in a massive violation of the federal election laws by raising millions of dollars and spending that money in violation of the spending limits that applied to them, and by spending what's called soft money in the presidential campaign, which is not supposed to be spent in federal elections. Those are the important questions. This issue about the Pendleton Act really is something of a distraction.
Well, Don Simon, let's talk about what Janet Reno exactly decided, and if you think that she will eventually appoint an independent prosecutor when it comes to campaign fundraising.
The only question she decided yesterday was whether or not to appoint an independent counsel to examine the one specific, narrow, technical question of whether the Pendleton Act was violated. And on that, for reasons that she stated and which indeed may be right, she decided not to seek the appointment of an independent counsel. But I think what's going on is that she's looking at a very small tree and missing the forest that she's standing in, because there are a whole series of very serious allegations about what happened in the 1996 campaign, and the Attorney General has consistently refused for over a year now to move forward to seek an independent counsel to look at those very, very important questions. And that's what's distressing here. I think the director of the FBI, Louis Freeh, has gotten it right when he says that What there needs to be is an investigation of a broader pattern of activities and potential illegalities in the 1996 campaign, not just this technical question about the Pendleton Act. And for that broader investigation, we really do need an independent counsel because the Attorney General has a conflict of interest. Again, I think Director Free has it right, and the Attorney General is really not conducting this matter in a way that has public credibility.
I want to see if you agree with Jamin Raskin. He was talking to Pacifica Network News yesterday. He's a law professor at American University. He says, like you do, that the larger issue of campaign finance reform remains unresolved, but he has some pretty big statement to make.
It's possible still that an independent counsel could be appointed to deal with the major forms of illegality that took place in 1996, but I wouldn't hold my breath. I think that the Attorney General understands just how sensitive all of this is, and that if someone were to seriously pursue the way in which those campaigns were run, we would have something on the level of a constitutional crisis. If you think about what happened with the Teamsters election, there was some money that was essentially embezzled from the Union Treasury Fund and put into the campaign. Well, that forced them to essentially boot Kerry from the presidency of the Teamsters and to call for a new election. We've got abuses that are much more serious that took place in terms of the national presidential election. And so I think that there's a move among some parts of the power elite in America to say, let's leave well enough alone.
What do you think of that, what Jamin Raskin is saying, that you're talking about, going right up to the top when you look at the campaign finance, the fundraising illegalities?
Well, I think there was a massive illegal scheme in the 1996 campaign. I think it was a bipartisan problem. I think both the Clinton campaign and the Dole campaign raised and spent money in the millions of dollars that simply could not be spent under the federal election laws, that they both raised the so-called soft money and ran it through their political parties as conduits and controlled its spending in the presidential campaign, and that was illegal. And I think that because this is such a serious problem and such a massive potential violation, that there does need to be, and the independent counsel law requires, the appointment of an independent counsel to investigate this matter, determine, in fact, whether laws were broken, and initiate prosecutions. Unfortunately, I also, along with Jamie, would not hold my breath waiting for the Attorney General to do that, because consistently over the past year, she has refused to take the step, which I do believe is authorized and required under the independent counsel law to provide for that kind of investigation.
Well, it sort of reminds me of Tom Foley, who was the Speaker of the House before Newt Gingrich, when it came to the whole Iran-Contra scandal. I mean, he was a Democrat. The Iran-Contra scandal involved the Republican President Bush. And ultimately, they didn't really pursue it because he said they didn't want to shake the institution of the presidency. So it's almost a bipartisan, shoring up of whatever goes on within the office of the presidency.
Well, I don't know if that's the situation here. I mean, I think the Republicans in this instance have been quite aggressive and quite insistent that the Attorney General appoint an independent counsel. But I think what's at stake in this matter is really the integrity of our election laws and whether there are going to be meaningful, enforceable rules that govern how we run our presidential campaigns. The way the system is supposed to work is that presidential candidates who decide to accept public money to run their campaigns agree to abide by a spending limit, that the laws require only certain kinds of money, the money given by individuals subject to a contribution limit, be spent in presidential elections. And what we saw in the 1996 campaign is those laws just openly and, I believe, willfully violated. And if we're going to have any meaningful rules that protect the integrity of our presidential campaigns, then those rules have got to be enforced. And if there's evidence that those rules have been broken, there needs to be an investigation, and if appropriate, there needs to be prosecution. In this matter, because of who may be involved, because of the widespread nature of this problem, and because of the obviously highly charged political atmosphere, this is a kind of classic case of what the independent counsel law is all about, because I don't think there can be real public credibility in this kind of investigation of the DNC and of high-level officials in the White House. There can't be public credibility of this kind of investigation if a political appointee, the Attorney General, is in charge of the investigation. This is precisely the kind of case where we need a definitive, independent investigator to come in and sort through these problems.
And yet it's interesting because it's not as if Attorney General Janet Reno is in the inner circle of President Clinton. In fact, they have not gotten along quite a bit over the last term and a half.
Well, I mean, that's true. She's not as close to the president as other attorneys generals have been in other administrations. But I still think some version of the same problem remains, where that there's not going to be real public credibility in the investigation and public confidence in the outcome of the investigation if it's conducted by a political appointee.
What about the FEC, Don Simon? Again, Don Simon, Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Common Cause, the Federal Election Commission. Where is it in all of this?
Well, the world is basically, the election law world is basically divided into criminal matters and civil matters. The Justice Department, the Attorney General, or if necessary, an independent counsel, has jurisdiction to conduct all criminal investigations. The FEC has jurisdiction to conduct civil investigations for civil violations of the law. The FEC could be conducting a civil violation. We don't know because all of its investigations are confidential. I assume that they're looking at these matters. But again, if there are criminal violations, if the law was broken in a knowing and willful way, then that's a criminal matter, and that has to be done by the Department of Justice, not by the FEC.
So where is this all going to fall out right now? You had Louis Freeh, the head of the FBI, pushing Janet Reno very hard to appoint an independent prosecutor. She didn't in this case. People within now are calling for an independent prosecutor still, and she can still appoint one. How does it fall out politically for them? And in terms of the big question of campaign finance in this country, what do activists need to learn from this who want to take out dirty money from politics?
Well, I think we're going to, over the next days and weeks, see a continuation of this controversy. I don't think that the Attorney General's announcement yesterday has resolved this in any fashion. I think it really is quite important that Director Freeh has taken a public position, a strong public position in direct opposition to the Attorney General's announcement, and I think that is going to really fuel the controversy, because this is not just a partisan dispute. It's not just the Republicans trying to get the president and using the independent counsel mechanism as a weapon. I think when you have the director of the FBI, who's quite respected, say, look, you know, don't focus on these little narrow technical questions. Look at the big picture here. And when you look at the big picture, that examination needs to be done by an independent counsel. I think when you have the director of the FBI making those points, it really is quite important and lends a lot of credibility to the view that the Attorney General has just gotten it wrong in this instance. So I think the controversy will continue, and I think there will continue to be pressure on the Attorney General to turn the investigation over to an independent counsel, but I think it's increasingly less likely that that will happen. Where that leaves the election laws, I think, is a real problem, because if at the end of the day there is no serious finding of illegality or prosecution of what happened in the 1996 campaign, then the sort of anything goes atmosphere that controlled in 1996 is going to become the new norm, and there's not going to be any effective or meaningful restraint on the kind or amount of money that we spend in our presidential campaigns, and that will cause the radical erosion of the post-Watergate reform laws. And I think that's a serious problem, and it just sort of underlines the need for Congress to pass campaign finance reform and to to really put in place a better enforcement mechanism and better laws so that we can restore the integrity to our elections.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking to Don Simon, Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Common Cause, a nonprofit, nonpartisan lobbying organization promoting open and accountable government. If you'd like to reach Common Cause on their website, where they have a lot of information on who are the contributors, because let's not forget it comes down to those specifics and how much money they have contributed over the last 2 years, you can go to www.commoncause.org. It's an invaluable resource. That's www.commoncause.org. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Speaking of Louis Free, we're going to talk about the FBI and specifically the Crime Lab when we come back. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of newly released FBI documents show a pattern of racial bias and incompetence at the FBI's once highly touted crime lab. This according to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. The FBI memos, part of 60,000 pages generated by an 18-month investigation by the Justice Department Inspector General's office into the crime lab, also show repeated favoritism towards prosecutors. The memos obtained under the Freedom of Information Act come in the wake of a scathing internal report released this past April that criticized the lab and its leadership for flawed reporting and inaccurate testimony, including in major cases like the World Trade Center and the Oklahoma City bombings. We're joined right now on the telephone by Gerald Lefcourt. He's the president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and we're testing our cellular technology here because he's on a cellular phone in a plane. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jerry Lefcourt.
How you doing?
Not bad. Well, can you tell us about what you found through these FOIA requests that you made, the Freedom of Information Act requests?
Firstly, we brought this suit first to get the Inspector General's report released, which we accomplished, and then we went back to the judge and asked for the documents that contain interviews with various lab personnel that produced the 500-page report that the Inspector General released. This is, don't forget, a government investigation of the government laboratory, the FBI laboratory. And looking at some of the documents we've received approximately 10% of the 60,000 pages of interviews that were conducted that produced this report. In those 6,000 pages, we have interviews with FBI lab personnel who quite frankly say in numerous instances that there was testimony that was incorrect, that FBI lab people tried to favor the government. For an example, in the Oklahoma City bombing case, when the agents' explosive unit lab people went to the scene, they were contacted by a special agent in the field who said that they found evidence that Terry Nichols had bought ammonium nitrate. And the agent in the field wanted to know from the expert lab people, the so-called scientists, was the bomb that exploded ammonium nitrate? And, of course, they were willing to help, even though they later admitted under stern questioning that they had no idea what the contents of the bomb was, and that they were saying that just to help the prosecution. That's a small example of numerous documents which show sloppiness and other lab people saying that really there is a lack of expertise and science involved in many of the statements of FBI lab people.
Gerald Lefcourt, you also talk about racism, indications of it, and destruction of records. Can you talk about those memos?
Sure. There are two memorandum of interviews, one with a special agent in the lab whose name is blocked out of the papers that we received, who reported that one of the agents in the DNA lab would try to help the prosecution convict Afro-Americans. This person was so routinely doing this, he was fired, and his name has so far been withheld from the report. Now, the fact that he's been fired is surely welcome news, but how many cases did he already report on that affected Afro-Americans? That's something we intend to go back to court and try to get the judge to order disclosed to us by giving us the name of the agent who reported him and the name of the person who was supposedly fixing reports to affect Afro-Americans. Another report showed that there was what they call proficiency tests done in the DNA section of the lab. A proficiency test is supposed to be one that tests the procedures to see if they're really accurate. And, of course, the better proficiency test would be a blind test, namely when they don't know they're being tested. However, there was a test that was conducted that was not a blind test, that everybody knew was a test, and everybody except one person in the DNA section failed the test. And so what did the report disclose? They disclosed that they then destroyed the test so that defense lawyers could not discover them in cases involving DNA. So those are the type of documents we found, and it's quite shocking. And it really, we want a full external investigation of the FBI lab. External, that means not by the government, some outside agency. The FBI lab is not accredited. Most labs in the country are accredited by outside agencies that do blind testing, that check protocols. The FBI lab is sort of like singularly on its own, sort of above the mob and saying we're the best without anybody knowing if they really are. And this report shows that there's tremendous problems, and we're very concerned about it.
What is Louis Freeh doing about them, the FBI director who's being hailed by many right now as the upholder of the truth, the one who wants an independent prosecutor, putting pressure on Attorney General Janet Reno?
Well, the only thing that he's done to date, rather than make all this stuff public and consent to outside accreditors, is that he's appointed a new lab director, Donald Kerr, whose background is really not in the type of forensic sciences of the lab, but more in the area of management. He hopes that with a strong manager, the FBI lab will come into shape. The problem is that the internal report by the government of the lab, this 500-page report, has identified just in three, they only looked at three sections of the 24 sections in the FBI lab, and in those three sections, they found enough material to involve 13 different lab personnel in misconduct, many of whom we have no idea whether their previous cases have been checked to see how they affected people's lives. And, the sad thing is that the numbers of innocent people now being discovered in places on death row even is quite shocking. For instance, in Illinois, they have executed 8 people from death row in the same period of time that 10 people on death row who were convicted and sentenced to death, awaiting to die, have been proven scientifically innocent. These are shocking statistics.
We're talking to Gerald Lefcourt. He's the president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, has represented people like Abby Hoffman and the co-defendant of Junk Bond King, Michael Milken, and has gotten these memos under the Freedom of Information Act about the FBI crime lab. We're also joined on the phone by Jeff Stein, a journalist who covers national security and criminal justice affairs. His work has appeared in The Washington Post, Playboy, GQ, and the online publication Salon. You have a piece in Playboy magazine of April 97, Bad Blood at the FBI, Jeff, where you talk about, similar issues, and particularly focus on Special Agent Frederick Whitehurst, one of the FBI's top bomb experts, at least he was.
Yes, that's right. And you know what strikes me, and I think Gerald might back me up on this, is when I began to research the lab 4 years ago, what struck me was it's amazing that these problems in the lab haven't been gotten scrutiny before. one of the assistant directors of the FBI, William Sullivan, who died under some mysterious circumstances in New Hampshire years ago, wrote a book about the Bureau, and he blasted the lab. I think because of Watergate focusing on political issues, the lab didn't get the scrutiny that other programs of the Justice Department and the FBI did. And it's just, and just because of Agent Whitehurst's tenacity in pressing for reforms in the lab, that it's come to the fore in recent years. But these problems have been ongoing for a long time, and the lab just somehow escaped the scrutiny that other issues at the FBI did.
Dr. Frederick Whitehurst is really the whistleblower that caused the internal government investigation of itself, of the lab itself. And Whitehurst, unfortunately, instead of being heralded as a hero, which he really is, because he really forced these issues and forced the Inspector General to start an investigation of the FBI lab. In the report, instead of praising Whitehurst, they actually criticize him. So the chance of another whistleblower coming forward is really slight, because Whitehurst has been suspended. They don't know what they're going to do with him. He's not working anywhere in the government. And the people that he criticized and that the report found had committed misconduct are still employed.
Yeah, I would point out also, Jerry, that the IG report is severely limited. It only investigated the charges that Whitehurst made.
And that only involved three sections.
That's right. Yeah. And so Whitehurst gave them the roadmap, and they looked into that, but they didn't report on abuses in many other parts of the labs, hair and fiber, tool marks, abuses in the polygraph program and so on, which is, I believe, going to be the next big issue out of the lab. And then they turned around and blasted Whitehurst himself as unfit for future duty because he had brought up all these problems in the lab.
Yep.
So it's the FBI, you know, we all want, I think, a proficient and professional FBI to fight crime. And we keep thinking with each new director after the Hoover era that we're going to get somebody who's going to clean up the place. And we keep getting disappointed. And I think Louis Free, despite the great press he's getting, is another disappointment. Whitehurst complained to Louis Free years ago when he first came in about problems in the lab, and Free ignored them.
You know, the thing that makes this terribly difficult is that at the same time we're having the lab exposed for all of these deficiencies, there have been tremendous cutbacks in the funding for Poor People's Counsel. Mm-hmm. And you know, there is really no way of a check on a scientist unless you have defense counsel that is well-trained, well-funded, and able to hire experts of their own to check out what the FBI laboratory scientists say.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, that plane is taken off. I'm going to have to hang up on you.
Well, thank you very much, Gerald Lefcourt, again, president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I don't want your cellular phone to interfere with the takeoff of the plane.
Okay.
So please hang up quickly.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. But we are still joined by Jeff Stein, a journalist who has looked at the FBI crime lab extensively. Jeff, you're just about to say something.
Yeah, I would say that's a very good point that Jerry made. We're now in the post-O.J. Simpson era, in which any good professional top criminal defense attorney is going to grill FBI lab experts who used to get a free pass in a criminal trial. In other words, the guy would be put on the stand, and the prosecutor would introduce him by saying, "Now, how many agent? How many cases have you investigated?" He'd say, "Well, I've investigated 2,000 homicides, and how many times have you testified?" "I've testified 1,000 times." You know, and no one used to ask them, "Well, exactly what scientific credentials do you have to make to testify on this issue?" And and juries would be very impressed by these neatly dressed FBI agents. And that's no longer the case if you have a terrific defense attorney. But the normal, you know, run-of-the-mill defendant who has a criminal past can be put on the stand by a defense attorney who's not as well prepared and doesn't have the time or the resources to investigate the background of the government's expert witnesses. In these kinds of cases, justice is very fragile, and poor criminal defendants are still going to be possibly victimized by fraudulent FBI lab procedures and testimony.
You know, tomorrow we're going to have on the show an extended conversation with James D. Nichols. People may remember that name. He actually was originally arrested in the Oklahoma City bombing, the brother of Terry Nichols, who's now on trial for involvement in that bombing. They said he was perhaps the mastermind, James Nichols, but then they set him free.
Right.
And he's written a book called Freedom's End, Conspiracy in Oklahoma. So we'll have a long conversation, and I know that he is going to raise the issue of the FBI crime lab, among other issues, and the idea that we don't even know if the bomb, in fact, was a fertilizer bomb, that you can't trust what the government puts out. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, what surprises me about the slow reaction of the FBI to clean up the lab is that it's really self-defeating in the end. They're going to lose cases because they've mishandled evidence. In other words, they may lose cases of a guy who's clearly guilty because they've mishandled the evidence. That's what lost the Simpson case. If you look back at the Simpson case, it was really the police and the police procedures that lost that case. People say it's a racial issue. Well, that may have been part of the jury's considerations, although most jurors have denied that. But it was the lousy handling of evidence by the police that really lost that case for the prosecution. And as long as the FBI lab continues to be under a cloud of suspicion and to put people on the stand who really are testifying beyond their expertise, or in some cases, as Whitehurst has alleged, doctoring their reports on the evidence, the government's going to lose cases against criminals. So it's not just an issue that they're framing people. It's that there are people that are being prosecuted who are guilty, but the FBI is going to lose their cases because they're mishandling the evidence. And why they don't shape up faster is puzzling to me. Having studied this issue for 3 or 4 years, I just don't understand why they don't move more quickly to clean up the place. Now, Jerry did bring up the point that the FBI lab is not accredited by an outside professional authority, and they resisted that. That was one of the things that Whitehurst demanded again and again, and his complaints only surfaced in 1995, but he had been agitating for reforms in the lab since 1986, as well as pointing out perjury and racism in the lab. The authorities who run the lab always resisted making any changes that he recommended. Now, finally, because of the IG report, the FBI lab is going to be eventually scrutinized by an outside crime lab authority, a scientific panel, and will undergo the same kinds of rigorous examination that other professional labs go through. But this is a long time coming, and it's only because the IG was pushed.
The
Inspector General of the Justice Department was pushed into exploring and examining Whitehurst charges because of the intense media coverage of Whitehurst's allegations. But otherwise, they'd repeatedly rejected getting into this, examining the lab. Whitehurst lobbied the FBI's own internal lawyers again and again for years to look at the lab, and they brushed them off. They just said he was a kook, and they brushed him off.
Whitehurst was an ex-Army sergeant. Again, he was one of the FBI's top bomb experts. Where is Frederick Whitehurst today?
Oh, yeah, I assume he's sitting home. He's not working. He's suspended with pay, and he has been suspended with pay for almost a year now. So, and he may be even subject eventually to criminal penalties.
Criminal penalties for what?
For unauthorized disclosure of information to outside parties, including Congress. The FBI is not covered by the Whistleblowers Act.
Is there a move to change that?
Well, there's a small move to change it, but the White House has rejected it repeatedly and did just a couple of weeks ago. The exemption is made for, you know, the usual reasons, national security, that great blanket that everybody hides under. And so the CIA and FBI and other elements of the government who deal with classified information are exempted from the Whistleblowers Protection Act. So that would be a terrific thing to get repealed, because you know, that just stopped. For example, there's a lot of financial shenanigans at the CIA. This is one of the great unreported stories about the CIA. About the CIA, you know, financial wrongdoing, malfeasance, ripoffs, etc. And it all gets covered up by national security, on the excuse of national security.
Well, Jeff Stein, I want to thank you very much for being with us, journalist who covers national security and criminal justice affairs. The piece we saw was in Playboy magazine, April 97, Bad Blood at the FBI, about an agent who turned whistleblower, Frederick Whitehurst. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank
also
you.
Has a piece in online publication Salon, has written for The Washington Post and GQ. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And when we come back, we're going to go to two international summits, the one on landmines that's taking place in Ottawa, the other on global warming that's taking place in Kyoto. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This week is a big week for international summits. In Ottawa today, more than 120 nations are expected to sign a treaty banning anti-personnel landmines. Delegates will also be drafting plans for removing the millions of mines now threatening civilians around the world. But several major producers and users of landmines, including the United States, China, and Russia, are sending only observers and will not sign. That's going on in Ottawa right now. In Kyoto, Japan, the ancient capital of Japan, the Global Warming Summit is taking place. We dealt with that yesterday on Democracy Now!, but we wanted to go back to it today as well. And the reason we wanted to do that is we wanted to look at these two summits and the role that the United States is playing. A major producer of landmines, they refused to sign the landmine ban. A major producer of greenhouse gas emissions, and they refused to go along with the international consensus around greenhouse gases. We want to welcome Mary Wareham, who joins us. She's the director of the U.S. Campaign to Ban Landmines. She is in Ottawa. And Callie Kreider, who is the director of the U.S. Greenpeace Climate Campaign. She is in Kyoto. Let's first go to get an update on what's happening in Ottawa right now with Mary Wareham. Where does the treaty stand as we speak?
We're pretty excited. It looks like, I hate to say, but it looks like 125. I'm looking at the list right now. It is absolutely stunning. We've got a plenary session taking place right now, which was opened up by Canada's Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien. Then they had Kofi Annan spoke, Secretary General of the United Nations. Now Cornelius Somaruga is speaking. He's the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross. And then we're looking forward to Jody Williams, the coordinator of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. Then they're going to start signing the agreement. This conference site is built for to hold about 400 people. There's 1,700 people here. Each nation gets 15 minutes to sign the treaty, and they're going to be short for time. It's quite an incredible achievement.
Well, the United States won't be getting its 15 minutes of fame on this day.
No, they won't. You know, they've sent a small delegation here. They've sent it here to talk about mine clearance, demining. That is where the United States sees it can carve a role for itself, but And we're like, fine, you know, nobody has anything against demining. We need the demining to continue and the funding to continue for it. But it's just a little bit hypocritical to be the leader on this while you still continue the right to put the weapon in the ground.
So tell us exactly what it is that these 125 countries are signing today.
they are going to, after it goes into effect, when it is ratified by 40 nations, these nations will agree not to deploy anti-personnel landmines, to destroy their stockpiles of anti-personnel landmines within 4 years, and to attempt to lift any uncleared anti-personnel landmines from their territory within a 10-year time period. And if that's not possible, of course, for Cambodia or Mozambique or Angola, who have literally millions, then they can explain why and see if we cannot get some more money to them. So it's a complete prohibition. There are no loopholes, no exceptions, which is what we were fearing when the treaty was negotiated in Oslo. It's a very good, strong, unambiguous document.
Mary Wareham, let's go to Kelly Kreider, the director of U.S. Greenpeace Climate Campaign, who is in Kyoto, Japan right now. Can you give us an update on the Global Warming Summit and particularly the role the U.S. is playing? I know that it seems that they are changing their position each day, and we'd like to know what the latest news on the U.S. position is.
Well, it's somewhat of an ever-shifting sand here. Right now, we are just in the end of the third day of negotiations that officially started on Monday in Kyoto. The U.S. has sent a large delegation here, and it was announced yesterday that Al Gore will be coming over perhaps for one day, not participating as part of the U.S. delegation, but more of an observer and to give an address to folks who are here. The U.S. position essentially is a 0% reduction in greenhouse gases in the year 2010 based on 1990 levels, which is essentially what the Bush administration agreed to do in the year 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit.
Didn't Clinton, when he was running for president, blast Bush saying that he was against the environment for setting such a late date?
In fact, yes, both Bill Clinton and Al Gore at that time said that George Bush was an obstruction to progress because the target was too small and that it wasn't legally binding. Now, all these years later, we have the Clinton administration coming in and saying that they need, you know, realistic targets and all of these sorts of things. So, yes, it's quite hypocritical.
What kind of effect does that have on reaching an agreement on cutting greenhouse gas emissions at Kyoto? What kind of effect does the U.S. position have?
Well, for better or for worse, you know, the U.S. is the most important player here, offset a little bit by the European Union and Japan. It's had quite a chilling effect in terms of trying to get a reduction target. Lots of folks, including the Alliance of Small Island States, groups like Greenpeace and others, wanted to see reductions begin in 2005 and for those to be reductions. And, you know, there's a lot of brinksmanship going on here because the ministers arrive this weekend, and it's the ministers who, in fact, have the final say. But it certainly put the kibosh on the momentum when Clinton made his announcement in November about the U.S. position.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Kylie Kreider, director of U.S. Greenpeace Climate Campaign. She's in Kyoto at the Global Warming Summit. Mary Wareham is on the phone with us from Ottawa at the Summit on Landmine Prohibition. In actually just a little while, it sounds like 125 countries will be signing that treaty, though the U.S. will not be a part of that. Mary Wareham, as you listen to Kelly Kreider and what she's going through in Kyoto as a member of an environmental grassroots group, and you look at all the years that you've spent on your issue, what comment do you have?
Well, it sounds like she's going through what we went through in Oslo, Norway, for 3 weeks in September when the treaty to abolish landmines was finally negotiated. And that was where this issue radically changed. Arms control and disarmament and the traditional means of doing business diplomatically through the United Nations. At that conference, probably the most important decision which was taken was that the conference would not operate by consensus, that it would be up to a simple majority, so that if the nations present could not agree by general agreement, and that is how the chair of that conference put it, then they'd take it to a vote. There were about 89 countries present, including the United States. And when the United States kept doing the number crunching, it could never come up with more than a third of the nations present to support any one of its positions. And any one of its positions could have weakened the treaty significantly. But it never actually came down to a vote because they did not want to be embarrassed there. They, you know, the kind of things they wanted was a geographic exception in the treaty for Korea, redefine what we were sitting there trying to ban, which is anti-personnel landmines, and delay when the treaty took effect by a decade. These kind of things which would have gutted the treaty, but they didn't get them through because we were not operating in that way. So we're very, very, very fortunate, and it's a kind of hopefully a good indicator of where we can go in the field of arms control and disarmament. And I don't know if the lessons learned are transferable over to other environmental issues like the one which is going on in Kyoto.
Kelly Kreider, how does the decision-making take place in Kyoto? Is it consensus right now?
Yes, I mean, there's subgroups upon subgroups upon subgroups at work here. And, you know, you essentially, we have a couple of issues. You know, first of all, we have corporate interests here, a vast array of them, because, of course, you have the coal interest, the oil interest, the automobile makers, who are lobbying quite fiercely.
We had the American Petroleum Institute on yesterday, the Oil Industry Association, also the American Automobile Manufacturers Association.
Quite familiar with those folks. And, yes, I mean, at this stage, they're trying to come up with what's the target, what's the timetable, what are the mechanisms that they're going to use to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, what counts as a greenhouse gas, what doesn't. So there's, I would say, a high state of uncertainty. And you're right. I mean, the landmines example is an interesting one because there are a set of trade-offs or important questions, you know, from our perspective, and I'm sure from hers as well. You know, a bad treaty is almost worse than no treaty at all because it can lock you into a state where the public becomes complacent because they think the problem is solved, when in fact all you have is a bad treaty that's a bureaucratic mess.
Yeah, that's what we feared. We'd be arguing the footnotes of the bad treaty here in Ottawa in December.
That's right.
We're just looking to universalizing it and implementing it and monitoring it. We're very, very fortunate.
Well, really, congratulations on that because it's quite a difficult thing to determine. And, you know, obviously our group has, you know, what our threshold is for something we would support, something we wouldn't support. And we're in quite fierce negotiations because of the loopholes that you're mentioning earlier, Mary. That, you know, of course we have the same things here. They want to exempt fuels that are in airplanes. They want to exempt HFCs, which are the gases that replaced ozone-depleting chemicals, you know, just on and on and on.
Kelly Kreider, what's your bottom line at the Global Warming Summit? What are you demanding and what will you not accept?
Well, we will not accept a treaty that does not include a significant early reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. That means starting no later than 2005, including all six major greenhouse gases that are emitted by humans, caused by the burning of fossil fuels mostly, and you know, rules and procedures that, you know, allow this treaty to be strengthened in the near term so that we can get the thing strengthened. So we have a pretty hard line.
Mary Wareham, where do you go from here? You'll have 125 countries that sign on to this total prohibition of landmines, the U.S. not being one of them, where your organization is based, the U.S. Campaign to Ban Landmines. So what do you do next?
Oh, we just did a massive cross-country journey for 5 weeks called the Ban Bus to Ottawa, just testing out the grassroots, seeing what interest is there. And it was phenomenal, the support and the media coverage. And that's where we've got to go, back to the grassroots, you know, and onto a meeting in Korea in February, probably, onto a meeting in Hungary, India, you know.
What are these meetings? What are these meetings?
The one in Korea, I think, will be for the campaigns in these recalcitrant states like the United States and Finland, although Finland looks as if it's going to change now, plus for the regions which need still some work, like the Asian region, even though we have got Japan, Indonesia, and Malaysia Cambodia, Philippines signing on to this. We're just going to pluck off the rest of them and make sure they do what they say they're going to do.
Mary Wareham, you mentioned demining. The U.S. is talking about helping to demine in other countries. But where is the money going? Who is doing the demining?
That's the question. We met with Ambassador Indefis, who has been appointed as the landmine czar, or the demining czar by the Clinton administration. And, you know, we said, you know, sure, we've got to put money into this, and you're not putting money into this with your new announcement. And it's like, Kelly, it's 2010. I don't know what the administration has about that date, but they want to get rid of the world's landmines by 2010. And we're like, look, we've been trying to do this for a long time. We need money. We need assistance. But you've got to look at not where your money's coming from, but where it's going, because where, unfortunately, it seems to be going is into training up other people's militaries. You know, they just announced new demining contracts to Chad and to Egypt. And I don't know where that's going to go. Those countries aren't signing a treaty. This has got to be matched up with the political commitment to get rid of the weapons.
So just a second, like the drug war where they say they're putting into money into fighting drugs, but they often go into shoring up repressive militaries, the demining money is going to train, they say, militaries in other countries to get rid of mines. Who do you think should get rid of the mines?
I think it's the non-governmental organizations working with the United Nations, working with these commitments from countries like the United States together to ensure that indigenous capacities are built up to deal with this problem over the long term, because it is a long-term problem requiring real capacity to deal with it. It'll happen. It's just going to take a while, and we want to work with the administration on the demining, but we're just looking to see if it's going to fly at the moment, because we need some accountability here with what is currently going on and what needs to happen as well.
Well, I know, Mary Wareham, that your group is headed on to Oslo, after this, because Jody Williams and the campaign to ban landmines is receiving the Nobel Peace Prize on December 10th. Do you have any final words of wisdom for Kelly Kreider at the Kyoto Summit?
I just say good luck and get some sleep, Kelly.
Thanks. It's almost midnight here. And congratulations on the Peace Prize. That's just fabulous.
Thank you.
It demonstrates the amazing work you all have done.
Kelly Kreider, one last question. How many grassroots organizations are in Kyoto right now?
Not very many. It's hard to tell because they're NGOs from all over the world, but I would say probably maybe 10 or 15% of the groups. And I would also say I think the reason why the Clinton administration likes the year 2010 is it's after a proposed Al Gore presidency.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, and also want to leave you a moment to give us your websites or phone numbers to get in touch with your organizations. Mary Wareham, the U.S. campaign to ban landmines, where can people call or go on the World Wide Web?
I suggest today and tomorrow that they call out the White House hotline on 202-456-1111, or go down to Lafayette Park tomorrow and see the president in a mask being dragged along to sign this agreement. Yeah, we're having a little bit of street theater tomorrow. The website for the campaign is www.vvaf.org. You can get to both international and U.S. campaigns through
there.
And
that's the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. www.vvaf.org. It sounds like there's still a lot of work to do in this country, even with the signing of the landmine ban. And Kelly Kreider, Greenpeace.
We're at www.greenpeaceusa.org, and we also have some street theater planned tomorrow.
Cool.
Oddly enough. But you can also call us in Washington at 202-462-1177.
That's 202-462-1177. Well, I know it's very late in Kyoto, so thank you very much, Kelly Kreider. Now get some rest. Kelly Kreider from the U.S. Greenpeace Climate Campaign in Kyoto for the Global Warming Summit. Mary Wareham, director of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines in Ottawa for the signing of the landmine ban. Well, that ends today's show. If you'd like to get a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, an extended conversation with James Nichols, the brother of Terry Nichols, on trial right now for the Oklahoma City bombing. We hope you join us for that conversation. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Joe Gill, help from Washington, D.C., and Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.